Hello and welcome to Behind the News for Saturday morning, November 28th, 2009. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. My show on WBAI, where this originates, was preempted this week for the Thanksgiving holiday Indigenous programming, so this is a show expressly designed for the KPFA and podcast audiences. My only guest today is Bob Meister, professor of political science at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who will talk about the University of California crisis. We'll hear from him at the bottom of the hour. After my usual opening remarks, I'm going to hold forth about financial reform. I don't do this very often, but I did want to vent about what Washington is up to with financial regulation. First, some comment on the economic news. Iceland, only about 80 degrees warmer? The latest sovereign financial crisis is Dubai, whose national holding company declared on Thursday that it needed to stop servicing its debts for a few months. Wouldn't it be nice if all of us could do that? Dubai is a small country, less than 1,600 square miles, on the Persian Gulf. It is one of seven members of the United Arab Emirates. The population is only about 1.5 million, three-quarters of them male, and less than a fifth are citizens. Most of the population consists of imported workers, mainly from South Asia. Although the basis of Dubai's wealth is oil, its worldwide reputation has come from Dubai World, its government-owned investment company. One of Dubai World's subsidiaries attracted a lot of ugly attention here back in 2006 when it tried to acquire some port operations in the U.S. Washington loves free trade and free capital flows when it's calling the shots, but if an Arab entity is involved, demagogues quickly invoke national security. Back to the current crisis. The first thing that Dubai World isn't going to pay is about $4 billion owed by its real estate subsidiary that's due next week. Like many so-called sovereign wealth funds, Dubai's went wild during the bubble, investing both in domestic building boom and a foreign acquisition spree. Dubai's binge was exceptional, however. It built three artificial islands off the coast of the country and is in the midst of creating a 300-island archipelago off its shore as well. It bought, among other corporate assets, the Queen Elizabeth II, the ocean liner, not the monarch, the MGM Mirage in Las Vegas, the Union Square W Hotel in New York and the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami, Barney's, the high-end New York department store, a bunch of luxury golf and ski resorts, and a 20% stake in Cirque du Soleil, the Canadian circus or performance art troupe, or whatever it is exactly. Who's going to take the hit on this? Mainly, it seems, European banks, though many of them are denying that they will. The amounts involved are far smaller than the trauma that the U.S. mortgage market inflicted on the world. But this is a reminder that the financial crisis is still with us, optimists longing to the contrary. Adding to this crop of worries are concerns that Greece may have trouble servicing its government debt. Its economy is a mess, as we've encountered in a couple of interviews over the last few months with Yanis Varoufakis on this show, the Athens-based economist. I think we're in for years of troubles. I keep being struck by the continuing signs of economic trouble and the placidity in the political realm. In the U.S., despite an unemployment rate north of 10%, that's likely to rise further before beginning a painfully slow descent, the only disturbances are mainly coming from the right, the teabaggy right, consumed as it is with delusions that Obama is turning the U.S. into a socialist entity, if only. Returning to the more familiar realm, how's this holiday shopping season going to be? Economic analysts always obsess over the results from Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, when the season traditionally begins, although I started seeing holiday promotions several weeks ago, and the Christmas lights are already up on some of the shopping streets around my neighborhood in Brooklyn. So far, retailers are looking scared, and have been very slow to do the usual November hiring. Early reports are that shoppers are out, but concentrating on necessities and bargains, with discounters in the lead, and luxury retailers only moving the cheaper stuff. What a change from a few years ago, when luxury, or at least aspirational outlets like Tiffany, were booming and Walmart was lagging. Now Walmart is thriving as consumers trade down. Saks's flagship store in Fifth Avenue in New York reported that people were buying deeply discounted Christmas ornaments and Godiva chocolates, but leaving the couture on the racks. It's looking like only the deeply discounted stuff is moving at all. This is all of more than immediate economic interest. Has this retail recession, the deepest in modern American history, changed the whole shopping culture in some structural way, or is it just a drawn-out cyclical affair? My guess is that something structural is going on, but you never know. At least I haven't seen any reports of people being killed over $19 DVD players at doorbuster specials. Yet. In other economic news, first-time claims for unemployment insurance, filed by those who've just lost their jobs, declined by 35,000 last week, and are now at the lowest levels in nearly a year. And the count of those continuing to draw benefits, available only with a week's delay, fell by 190,000 the week before last to its lowest level since March. The pace of layoffs continues to slow, but the rate of hiring has barely begun to increase. Perspective on this can be obtained from a fairly obscure data series from the Bureau of Labor Statistics known as Business Employment Dynamics. The familiar monthly figures on job gains and losses are just net results, the difference of between a truly massive number of gross gains and losses in jobs. For example, in the first quarter of this year, the most recent stats available, we lost about 2.7 million jobs. But that loss was a result of 8.5 million jobs lost and 5.7 million gained at the gross level. That's a little amazing. Even at the nastiest spot in this recession, almost 6 million people got jobs. Of course, a lot more were losing them. The losses in the first quarter of the year were about 8% of total employment, and the gains about 5%, a record low. But amazingly, that loss rate is actually lower than it was in the 2001 recession. What's really been out of line is the low rate of gain. Even at the worst spot of that 2001 recession, gains were 2 percentage points of employment higher. So the decline in claims for unemployment insurance that I quoted earlier has to be understood in this light. Employers aren't laying people off as harshly as they were early in the year, but there's no sign they're about to start hiring in any meaningful quantity. Okay, let's take a musical break, and I'll be back to talk about financial regulation. That was a bit of Sleepyhead's Communist Love Song, the title track of their 1996 CD, which you can buy now at used on Amazon for $2.28. We'll hear some more of that anthem of romantic disillusionment in a bit. I almost never do this sort of thing. In fact, I can't remember the last time I did. This sort of thing meaning holding forth at length, as opposed to my brief opening commentaries. But today, an exception. What follows is drawn from an article I wrote for the newsletter I edit, Left Business Observer, the issue that was just sent off to subscribers. The title, Regulating Finance, Coddle, Jiggle, or Stifle. Everyone with a tolerably close relationship with reality agrees that our financial regulatory structure needs a serious overhaul. Over the summer, the Obama administration got the ball rolling with a set of proposals for a new regulatory architecture, a favorite word of the pundits. And then as summer turned into fall, Congress took some time out from making a mess of the healthcare system and got into the act. While it's all very much a work in progress, it's worth contemplating what the issues are and what direction the executive and legislative branches are likely to take. One of the crazy things about the U.S. financial regulatory system, like just about everything else in this country, is its intense fragmentation. There are multiple federal agencies governing different sectors. Securities markets are regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. Commodities markets by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC. Commercial banks by the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and the Comptroller of the Currency. Savings and loans by the Office of Thrift Supervision, and that's by no means a complete list. Oh, and then some sectors aren't regulated at all. Oh, and some sectors aren't regulated at all, like municipal bonds. And the insurance business is only regulated at the state level. States also regulate banks and security trading. No one has a formal responsibility for how it all fits together. Bucks are passed, turf is guarded. Regulators are organized around sectors and focus mainly on individual institutions, even though links between institutions and sectors mean that trouble in one place can quickly metastasize to another. Who could have guessed, aside from the usual gang of worrywarts, that mortgage delinquencies could have led to AIG blowing up, which threatened the meltdown of the entire global financial system? The Fed has an informal supercop role, but it mostly slept complacently through the bubble and hasn't done much to stop a new one from forming. The administration's original proposal was a mixed bag. Among its better features was the creation of a new agency to regulate consumer finance, something the industry hates with a blinding passion, and some vague schemes to regulate derivatives, on which more in a moment. They'd also begin to regulate insurance at the federal level, and they'd require that banks retain an interest in the loans that they securitize, instead of packaging all the loans that they extend into bonds or derivatives and selling them to other financial interests like hedge funds and pension funds and getting them entirely off their books, they'd have to keep a share. Presumably, this would make them less eager to make instant junk loans and pass them along before sunset. But instead of cleaning up the fragmented regulatory structure, the administration scheme would add new layers of complexity. Chat shops, where the various regulators call things like coordinating councils. And states would continue to regulate insurance and some banks. It's not clear how this would fix things, though it might provide ambitious young JDs and MBAs with some government experience before they cash in on Wall Street. The derivatives issue is arcane, but crucial. One of the things that got us into trouble was the way that Wall Street created mysterious customized securities by mixing together mortgages of varying quality and getting the rating agencies to stamp them AAA. The buyers of these things often didn't really know what was inside them, which was fine with the sellers, because they wanted to get the junk off their books quickly and make a few bucks in fees in the process. Although the most recent trouble came from mortgages, in the next cycle it could be something entirely different, from the right to emit carbon, or future revenues of nanotech patents, or anything else that the finest minds of Wall Street could slice, dice, and repackage. It would be nice to make it as difficult as possible for Wall Street to do those things. A good way to get a start on that would be to make it hard to create, sell, and trade customized derivatives, to force, as much as possible, them to be standardized and to trade on exchanges, like today's pork belly, gold, treasury bonds, or British pound futures. Terms would be clearly disclosed, and players would be required to put down serious cash down payments, margin, as it's known in the trade, and demonstrate that they're good credit risks should things turn sour. That wouldn't put an end to bubbles and busts. The stock market crash of 1987 was in no small part the result of an aggressive use of exchange-traded futures contracts, as was the oil bubble of 2006-2007. But it would be a serious step in the right direction. Barney Frank's original House draft bill was pretty weak on derivatives. It did less than the administration's proposal to force more of them onto exchanges, and left wide custom-made loopholes for custom-made derivatives. Frank's bill would allow an end-user exemption, an exception for actual real-world companies to hedge against the risk of oil prices or exchange rates moving wildly against their plans. But that's an exception that investment bankers could easily game. In response to public pressure, Frank agreed to tighten up the language, but then Chris Dodd unveiled his Senate bill, one that was far tougher than anything the House, supposedly the more populous chamber, contemplated. It would force almost all derivatives tradings onto exchanges. Derivatives aren't the only area in which Dodd's bill is more sweeping, one hesitates to use the word radical in this context, than what either the House or the White House has proposed. It would also consolidate regulatory agencies, instead of drawing dotted lines between them on organizational charts, and savagely prune the power of the Federal Reserve to regulate the financial system. It also retains the Consumer Protection Agency. Dodd's war on the Fed is fascinating. The central bank hasn't been under such heavy fire since the double-digit interest rate era of the early 1980s. Aside from pruning its regulatory purview, Dodd's bill would also reform the governance of the Federal Reserve. Now the Fed consists of a 7-member board of governors in Washington, who are appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate, and 12 regional branches around the U.S. Each branch is run by a board, which consists of a mandating mix of 9 members, known as the Class A, B, and C directors, three of each kind. Classes A and B are elected by the member banks in the district, and Class C selected by the board in D.C. Class A directors are bankers, Class B are business people who cannot be bankers, and Class C are civilian worthies from the district. Dodd's bill would have all the directors chosen by the board in Washington. While this move is supposed to democratize and diversify things, it's almost certain that it would produce a mix of elite representatives very similar to the present cast of characters. In fact, it's quite possible that the mix could even be more banker-dominated than the current crew. Some of the regional feds have included labor and labor-friendly directors. Safe sorts for sure, and strongly outvoted by the business interests, but even that symbolic diversity would probably disappear if their successors were all chosen by Ben Bernanke. Dodd's proposal comes in the wake of a bill that would require the Government Accountability Office to audit the Fed. Introduced by the libertarian holy roller Ron Paul of Texas, it's attracted 311 co-sponsors in the House, including some of the lefter members of the House, along with leading lights of the right-wing nut caucus like Michelle Bachmann. Ron Paul hates government-run money and wants to replace it with a gold standard. As Paul says, gold has frequently been referred to as God's money, as only God can make more of it. So turning over control of money to human beings, according to Paul, is trespassing on God's territory. He really says this. Of course, the gold standard gave us multiple financial crises and depressions, along with decades of punishing deflation in the late 19th century, but when scripture speaks, history takes a deep back seat. Paul's personal lunacy aside, the proposal to audit the Fed is an interesting one, but it makes orthodox types squirm. Everybody would like to beat up on the Fed and make them the bad guy, said Representative Melvin Watt, a North Carolina Democrat. Watt says audits would substantially castrate the Fed so it could not do what it was set up to do. Substantially castrate? Leaving how large a residue behind, anyway. Of course, what the Fed was set up to do was to support the existing class structure, which is why it is so appealing to shine a light on its inner workings. Watt has introduced his own bill that looks like a milder version of Paul's that would, to appropriate his own metaphor, substantially castrate the auditing effort. Still, it's not entirely clear how increasing popular, which in this case probably means congressional, influence on monetary policy, it's hard to tell how this would play out. It's quite possible that a boneheaded populist alliance would have tried to block the rescue of the financial system last year, which would have meant we'd all be wearing barrels now. But of course an audit of how the Fed went about that rescue would be entirely welcome. They've handed out billions with no disclosure or accountability in an effort to restore the status quo ante. It may be a mistake to spend too much time studying these draft proposals, since they're almost certain to get worse, meaning more bank-friendly, as they work their way through Congress. But in a shocking development, the bank lobbyists have actually lost a few of the early rounds, especially on derivatives. Should something like the Dodd bill become law, which seems unlikely, given a unanimous Republican opposition and some complaints from some centrist Dems, we'd probably have a somewhat more stable financial system. But why limit our ambitions, at least in fantasy, to what congressional Democrats come up with? Since no one writes books with titles like The Role of Finance in the Transition to Socialism, the title of an actual book by Stephanie Griffith Jones, published in 1981, although she's eliminated the words to socialism on her CV. What follows is about somewhat improving the existing system, rather than making a wholly new one, as delightful as that would be. In a September speech on Wall Street, which many Wall Street hotshots didn't bother to attend, Ditherer-in-Chief Obama said that while he longed for serious financial reform, he didn't want to stifle innovation. How wrong that is. The point of financial reform should be nothing other than stifling innovation, which generally means the creation of products that allow bankers to transfer risk to unsuspecting or desperate customers while collecting big fees for that favor. It would be difficult to argue that the era of financial innovation has brought about any improvement in economic performance from the bad old stifled days. A first step in stifling innovation would be to separate the utility functions of finance, as providing basic functions like checking and savings accounts, from the wackier stuff. Those basic functions could be performed by private banks if they'd like, but it'd be really nice to have a public option here, like nonprofits, co-ops, and public institutions. Such deposits could go to fund sensible loans for businesses and consumers, and nothing pervy. As long as capitalism is with us, and it looks like that will be for a very long time, alas, we're going to have speculation. Regulation should be designed to keep it to a minimum. In a slightly imaginary world, the Federal Reserve would be the right institution for that task. It's staffed by smart, sophisticated people with a good view of the entire financial system and often a rich understanding of how finance interacts with the real world. It could easily step in and prick a speculative bubble before it expands to dangerous proportions just by saying stop or we'll take away your banking license. That would be nice. But the actually existing Fed serves as Wall Street's personal branch of government. That role was brought home during the AIG rescue when the New York Fed didn't even try to negotiate haircuts on the investment bank's exposure to the failing insurance company. In a normal bankruptcy, creditors usually settle for far less than 100 cents of the dollar, not AIG's creditors. Tim Geithner, then president of the New York Fed, now our Treasury Secretary, made them all whole. He could have easily said, "We're the state, here's 65 cents and don't forget to say thank you," but he didn't even try. Come to think of it, when you've got institutions that won't even use the power they have, and a president who thinks that financial innovation is a good thing, and the sort of exercise undertaken in the last couple of paragraphs is just daydreaming. It would be almost as fruitful to chant expropriate the expropriators, and a lot more fun. But given the imperative, enforced in some quarters, to offer constructive criticism, at least I made an uncharacteristic attempt. What you just heard was based on a piece I wrote for the new issue of the newsletter I edit, Left Business Observer. I promised no more lectures for a long time to come. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the University of California crisis. And that was more of Sleepyhead's Communist Love Song, the title track of their 1996 CD, A Relic of the High Indie Era. I'm going to grow my hair real long, smoke a ton of grass, stay up all night every night, discussing race and class. How many people actually did that in 1996? How many do it in 2009? Email me, dhenwood@panix.com. That's dhenwood, D-H-E-N-W-O-O-D, at panix, P-A-N-I-X.com, with your answers. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Next up is an interview with Bob Meister. Meister is a professor of political science at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and president of the Council of UC Faculty Associations. He's been studying the fiscal crisis of the California system and has a bunch of interesting articles on the Council's website, which is cucfa.org. They, along with a lot of other excellent material, are also available on the website Keep California's Promise at keepcaliforniaspromise, all one word, .org. That's cucfa.org and keepcaliforniaspromise.org. Okay, here's Bob Meister. Welcome, Bob Meister. Let's just start by taking a measure of just how serious the University of California's fiscal problems are. How bad are things right now?
Well, the state has cut $5 to $6 billion as a result of the financial crisis. And that's a lot of money. But it's a lot of money against a baseline that puts that amount of money in perspective. UC had a financial distribution formula for the money that it was getting from the state and from tuition, in which the disparities between the least, the worst-funded campuses and the best-funded campuses were as much as $15,000. That is to say, some campuses were getting less than the appropriation that they were generating through their enrollments from the state. So the state has caused a problem, and UC's internal policies for distributing state and non-state money are responsible for an even bigger problem, and both problems need to be addressed. UC needs to be more accountable for the money that it gets both from students and from the state on a per-student basis in order to justify the kind of trust that would be required for the state to restore funding to UC. Our view is that we could get back on a master plan trajectory with an additional cost of around $200 or $300 per citizen, which is a very good deal considering the opportunities that UC provides.
What is exactly this internal hierarchy? I'm guessing that UCLA and Berkeley are at the top, but what's responsible for the vast differences in funding?
Well, probably a lot of internal history. It's the argument that these campuses are more expensive because they pay higher salaries. It's a tad circular. But there is a tradition on some campuses of paying higher salaries than on other campuses. Part of what's responsible for the continuation of the problem is simple lack of transparency. I was on another radio show during the regions meeting at which three regions were present. I mentioned the fact that six UC campuses would be better off with an equal share, a fair share of tuition revenue plus state revenue if tuition were still at its 1992 level, which was about $1,500. Six of the 10 UC campuses would be better off. The response was that President Udall admitted this when he came into office and was shocked to learn it, And my response was, well, then why haven't you published the disparities in their formulas so that we can see whether the problem has gotten better or worse now that President Udall has doubled the tuition component of this formula? And they just said we have to do a better job. I don't think the system is sustainable now that tuition is a larger component of the per-student income of UC, the common income of all UC campuses, than the state component. I think it may have been at least rationalized when tuition was $1,500 that could be distributed for frills or special needs.
How do the problems at UC compare with those with the Cal State system or the community colleges?
Well, at a hard material level, the community colleges and the state systems are suffering more, cutting more classes, cutting more enrollments, becoming less accessible. At that hard level, what needs to be done is to address the whole master plan, the whole system of higher education, and put the whole master plan back on track, which could cost $2 to $5 billion a year, or less than could be generated probably by releasing nonviolent drug offenders who are in life, who are incarcerated for life, simply because of the three strikes rule. I mean, to put it in perspective, or a variety of other things could be done. That said, the disparity in the funding for UC over and above the state universities is much smaller than the internal disparities in UC's own funding formulas between its own campuses. So that said, while the cutbacks are uniform and their impact is greater on the community colleges, there is a much bigger problem in terms of UC's constitutional immunity from being held to account for the use of the funds that it already has. Our view, the view of my organization, is that the state constitution actually makes an exception and allows the legislature to regulate UC's use of its funds And that includes not merely its state funds, but certainly all of its enrollment-generated funds that it claims are simply necessary to replace state funds. So, you know, if the disparity between UC state funding of CSUs, I'm sorry, the disparity between California's funding of CSUs and UC's is $5,000 or $6,000 per student per year, the disparity between UC's funding of Merced versus, which is the newest campus, versus UCLA, was perhaps $18,000, $16,000 a year. In that respect, the problem is larger at UC.
How do the problems at California compare with those of other state university systems? I know that California's fiscal crisis is worse than any other states, but is it comparably true of the university systems?
Even before the fiscal crisis in California, California was on a much steeper curve for raising tuition than the other state universities. One reason that California went on this curve was when Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected governor through the recall that many people may remember, your listeners. He brought in a budget director from Florida named Donna Ardwin, who changed the theory on which UC funded itself and adopted a theory under which, well, using price theory, the price of higher education is the price. And that means that the price is independent of whether it's a public university or a private university, independent of whether its subsidy comes from taxpayers or from an endowment. And according to that theory, UC's price was simply too low because people nationally at comparably ranked universities were willing to pay a higher price. So while I was on the budget committee, this happened. Schwarzenegger came in, and UC was given carte blanche to operate under the new theory that doesn't distinguish between public and private universities. It was given carte blanche, in other words, to raise its tuition. And this is a huge change from the situation when I came on the budget committee, where UC was afraid that if it raised tuition, the state funding would simply be reduced. Here there was simply an expectation that state funding would tail off. Why should the state pay when the price of higher education was higher nationally than it was in California? Why shouldn't UC just gradually raise its price? How much was determined by the national price? When and in what increments might be determined by what you could persuade students to accept because of state budget cuts? But essentially, the view was that we would eventually replace a taxpayer-financed university with a debt-financed university. And when I asked the budget people who were proposing this whether this is in fact what they intended to do, it was over lunch. They turned to me and said, this was 2003, 2004, people are already borrowing 150% of their personal income for junk. Why shouldn't they borrow for education, and why should the taxpayers pay? So this was a theory that was adopted in 2003, 2004 that was in effect a theory that didn't distinguish between public and private institutions. And at the moment they adopted that theory, they swept all of the tuition revenue and all of their other discretionary revenue, everything but the state revenue essentially, and the restricted revenue they get for scientific research, the contract part of it rather than the overhead, and put it into a pool that could be leveraged as a capital purpose of financing capital assets. So they became conceptually private at that moment.
Speaking of private universities, though, my alma mater, Yale, has an endowment of about $20 billion, and they're in the process of raising another $3 billion from alumni over the next couple of years. To add to that endowment, I'm guessing that California doesn't have anything an endowment anywhere near in that territory.
California has a $5 billion, $6 billion endowment, and the endowment doesn't compound because all of the endowment gets thrown into the pool with tuition and everything else that's used to leverage capital projects. But Yale is a good example. My alma mater, Princeton, could be free. The theory that they're using is that people don't refuse to pay the exorbitant tuitions at Yale or Princeton because they could be free. And so the subsidy has no effect on the price. And their view is that means there's no difference between a public and private university. You can raise the price to whatever level you It's independent of the subsidy. So my point is that conceptually, theoretically, UC's reasons for raising tuition are independent of whether the state support declines or increases. It got a green light to raise tuition to the market price regardless. But how fast and how much and in what steps are politically dependent on telling people that you're replacing state funds. But in fact, tuition is unlike state funds in that UC regards them as functionally equivalent to an unrestricted gift that it can use in any way it wants, which is why you get these tremendous account disparities among campuses, because UC can essentially collect the money from students on an equal basis and send the money to projects, perhaps corporate industrial partnerships at certain campuses that have them, without being accountable to return the money to the campuses that generate it.
I'm speaking with Bob Meister, who teaches political science at the University of California, Santa Cruz. But of course, Yale and Princeton can tell their students that a degree from those institutions is basically an admission ticket to the ruling class. Can California tell its students the same?
Well, some of us may have declined the ticket, but California had a consensus that spanned Pat Brown's administration and Ronald Reagan's administration, that UC performed two functions, one, class reproduction, and second, class mobility, which is why Ronald Reagan introduced the first state income tax, mainly in order to keep UC free, after succeeding Jerry Brown as governor and running on a bash UC electoral platform. It is possible to rebuild a consensus that involves both class mobility and class reproduction, and that requires a low-cost form of higher education in which people who get high incomes as a result of their education are taxed because they get high incomes and not because it's the result of their education. California has moved away from that, and it's moved away from that partly because the demographics have changed, and they've changed both in terms of the age composition of the population. There's much more interest in investing in my generation, and I assume your generation's health care, just as there was interest when we were young in investing in our educations. And because the ethnic composition of the state has changed, the component of immigration is a large, unstated political issue in terms of who gets educated and who doesn't get educated in California and who is willing to pay for whom. In other words, politicians believe that there is less support. But ironically, you know, polling data shows almost as much support for higher education as a public value in California as ever. People don't come to California because of the prison system. They come to California because of the opportunities provided by the university. And were it not for the ways in which politicians frame the issues, I believe, and a lot of people, even in the press and in the national media, believe that that Californians wouldn't want to lose the public character of their public institutions, and that what needs to be said and what is beginning to be understood as a result of the student movement of the past month or two is that a public university with a different funding model, with a private funding model, is not simply the same university with a different source of funds. It's a fundamentally different sort of university. And people are now focusing increasingly, and this is what has to be communicated, focusing increasingly on the fact that UC is not going to be the same university with a different funding model and is not going to perform the same function that it has historically performed in the political and economic culture of the state.
You've been writing about how the university has been floating bonds to fund construction using the tuition revenues to secure the debts. Tell us about that. Why are they doing that?
Well, they're doing that partly to break free of dependence on the state. You know, the traditional model was that the state floated general obligation and lease revenue bonds to fund buildings such as classroom buildings and even administration buildings that were central to UC's mission. but that were not internal revenue producers and did not generate external revenues, and that there were particular types of construction that the state felt the taxpayers shouldn't fund, particularly dormitories, parking lots, famously dormitories and parking lots in the master plan, that had to be self-supporting and thus funded by revenue bonds that could be paid down using the fees generated by those projects. What happened in the period when Schwarzenegger came in the transition between Gray Davis and Schwarzenegger is that when UC got the green light to raise tuition, not just a green light, when it was obliged to raise tuition, when agreed to be obliged to raise tuition and phase out the state, it swept tuition, which is the largest growing component of UC revenues and the only component of UC revenue that is entirely under its control, into a common pool that could be used to fund construction, along with all other unrestricted revenue. In other words, it classified tuition as entirely different than the state appropriation. The state appropriation is a state appropriation. Tuition is simply a revenue flow that is that can be capitalized, it can be financialized from the point of view of UC construction. And the important point is that they, in order to maintain their bond rating, when they want to do more construction, they maintain their bond rating by raising tuition, by demonstrating that they can raise tuition, and by demonstrating that they have successfully raised tuition in the past without much protest. So their leverage remains the same if they continue to add to this fund by raising tuition. Now, the question is not whether they've done that. When I wrote an article called They Pledged Your Tuition to as an open letter to students, the administration shot back with a stinging retort saying the kernel of truth in this article is that we pledged their tuition. Of course we pledged their tuition. Their response is simply that all the funds are so commingled that until their entire bond capacity is exhausted, their bond issuing capacity is exhausted, even they don't know what component is being of tuition revenue is being used to fund buildings. The truth is that once they fund buildings out of a common pot of revenue that includes tuition, none of the buildings have to be self-supporting on the basis of the internal revenue they generate. So, in other words, they have lost all accountability for what is cross-subsidizing what. They don't know. They don't ask.
I'm speaking with Bob Meister, who teaches political science at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Why are universities so obsessed with construction? Does it have something to do with what architecture critics call the edifice complex?
Well, you might ask. If you put it to students, if you put it to faculty, I would rather teach my class in a new building than an old building, but I would rather have TAs than have a new building. Administrators don't get credit for maintaining the right ratio of TAs to students in a classroom. They do get credit for new buildings, and they justify it by hiring market researchers to talk about and study the brand of a university. They view themselves not as investing in the education per se, but investing in whatever improves the brand. And they think buildings do as much to improve the brand as educational quality. Branding. They think, and there's another dimension to it, which is, of course, that many of these new buildings, an increasing number of these new buildings, are research partnerships with industry. And since the research that is done by industry actually pays the university less overhead than the federal government, and since even the federal overhead is subsidized by enrollments, the university can build buildings that use its tax-free bond status to promote industrial policies and to provide an implicit subsidy to its private industry partners, which it is nowhere accountable for reporting.
The crisis in the California system is pretty striking because even very orthodox types, hardly Bolsheviks, would say that the university has been one of the keys to the state's long-term growth, which is spectacular, making it, as they like to say, the boosters like to say, one of the eighth largest economy in the world. Does anyone worry that they're undermining the foundations of that growth, even, again, in very orthodox terms?
Everyone worries, even those of us who are critics of the university. You know, one of the things I learned when I came to California 36 years ago is that everyone believes and wants to believe that the University of California is good and is a public good and has produced in the public a desire for education. In California and in California's political culture, education is really the name of a desire. And no one wants to say anything that will in any way diminish simply the cultural role that the desire for education, for self-improvement, plays in California politics. The people who are destroying the university are relying on the willingness of the public to believe it's still good. And those of us who are criticizing them for destroying the university need to harness that desire, the desire for education that the University of California has itself produced in this state. We all believe in the university, what distresses us most is that the willingness of the public to still believe in the university is being exploited while the university is turned away from its public purpose.
Is there any way that you see to turn things around, or is the fiscal and political situation so dire that the downward trajectory is irreversible?
Well, there are many ways that UC could turn things around. The university is right when it says that the state has been a poor partner. But one reason that the state has been a poor partner is that UC has been an equally poor partner to the state. You know, it exists as a public trust for the purpose of higher education. That's why it's allowed to hold property. That's why it's allowed to hold assets. And it has always taken the position that except for the pittance that it gets from the state, it's not accountable for whether it uses its property, its assets, for the purpose that justifies its creation as a public trust, as an autonomous public trust under the Constitution. UC must use its own money to promote higher education, and at the same time, it must become a recipient of more public money. Ronald Reagan spent a far higher percentage of the state budget and charged people a far higher percentage of their tax for higher education than any governor since then, including Jerry Brown himself, who is now running again. UC can, I think, make the case for public higher education if it's willing to be accountable also for how it uses the money that it already has. The serious question is whether the legislature and the governor are willing to give it more money in return for accountability, and whether UC itself is willing to change course, or at least correct course, in order to get more money. In other words, would it rather continue on the current path with less state money or change its path and get more state money? It isn't that much state money. It's only a few hundred dollars per taxpayer. It could come from a variety of sources, including releasing nonviolent third strike offenders, including eliminating enterprise zones, shopping centers and malls that have been tax-free for 30 and 40 years and that were made tax-free by a simple majority vote. Nobody knows whether it would take a simple majority vote to end those tax benefits. It could be funded by a small change in the taxes on oil extraction, the introduction of a proper tax on oil extraction. One of the things about UC is that although its problems are typical of national problems, it is such a highly valued public asset, and it would cost so little to fix higher education throughout the state, not just UC, but all three segments, community colleges and state universities, that it's actually a good place to start addressing these problems. to start looking at the relationship between user fees, taxpayer financing, and bond financing. This is an area where things can be fixed, and it could be a laboratory for thinking about these problems more broadly. The fact that the problem is everywhere doesn't mean you can't start somewhere, and this is a really good place to start.
Finally, it looks like the university administrations aren't the places to look for leadership for that sort of program. It looks like they're determined to privatize themselves. Is this true?
So it seems. I'm not sure that that would be the first preference of all of them. But they claim that they are doing it because they are forced to do it by the state. And what that means essentially is that they assume that they do not have to account for the policies that they are not willing to reconsider. Now, whether or not changing those policies would bring forth more state revenue, I don't know. But I do know that the end game for getting more state revenue will require greater trust going in both directions.
That was Bob Meister, professor of political science at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and president of the Council of UC Faculty Associations. For more, see the Council's website, cucfa.org, and Keep California's Promise, keepcaliforniaspromise.org. That's cucfa.org and keepcaliforniaspromise.org. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. I'll stay in the high indie rock mode I was in earlier in this program for today's outro music. Outro is radio speak for what comes on the other end of an intro, though Canadians, in their charmingly formal way, call it an extro. This is from Bedhead's 1998 album, Transaction De Novo, a song called Extra Mundane. Unpretentious they were not. Till next week, bye.
I can't.